Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zangerer, on the show this week.
There will always be loopholes because the law cannot foresee every possibility and every circumstance associated with it.
Joe Hockey's Last Act, a crackdown on multinational tax avoidance.
The committee judged it appropriate to wait for more evidence, including some further improvement in the labour market, to bolster its confidence that inflation will rise to 2% in the medium term.
We look at why the US decided to keep interest rates on hold and what it means for our economy.
Whenever we've talked to anyone about possibilities for getting funding in Australia, we generally run into the same theme about investors, which is that Australian investors are very conservative and don't like to take big risks.
And our special series on startups looks at the challenges of building a business without capital. That's all coming up. You're on the money. When former Treasurer Joe Hockey stepped up to the podium to deliver a press conference last week, there were expectations he'd discuss the leadership spill and whether he would remain Treasurer. Not so. Hockey kept to his script and refused to answer any questions from journalists. Instead, his focus was on announcing his long-awaited bill on addressing multinational tax avoidance had finally been presented to the Parliament. The government planned to hand the Australian Taxation Office $87 million to focus on the issue, and tough new laws will see companies who avoid tax forced to pay double their dues plus interest. The laws will apply to over 1,000 multinationals operating in Australia that have a global turnover of more than $1 billion. And there'll be mandatory disclosure of tax affairs for major public companies whose total income is more than $100 million. Joe Hockey wouldn't be drawn on how much revenue the measure could raise for the government, but Tax Commissioner Chris Jordan says the laws could potentially raise hundreds of millions of dollars. Accounting expert John Tyler from the UTS Business School says that depends entirely on whether we'll actually be able to collect the tax at all.
The important thing about any tax is not so much the announcement of it, it is the implication of it. And the implication has to do with, are you able to get people to pay more tax? Now, for you and me, that's really easy because we're paid here in Australia and our expenses are in Australia, and so it is very easy to work out what is our tax. But for companies that operate around the world, it is really difficult to determine what their expenses are in one location, especially when the services are provided from a multiple number of different countries.
We know that it's very tricky to make sure that companies can't actually wiggle their way out of any sort of tax arrangements that a sovereign nation tries to impose. When Joe Hockey first touted this legislation back in May, it was possibly going to target 30 different companies. Now it looks like it could target over 1,000 multinationals. Is this about Joe Hockey succumbing to pressure to widen the net?
No, not at all, I don't believe. What the 30 was that the Australian Taxation Office under Chris Jordan actually put 30 of his employees into 30 large companies to try and learn what they do and how they do it. If you are able to target any multinational, there is no point in simply keeping the number to some magical figure. Like the GST on goods purchased in Australia, anything that you set is going to be artificial. So I would suggest that any tax you have says that if a multinational company earns $1 in Australia, they should pay 30 cents of tax in Australia. If they earn $1 billion in Australia of taxable income, they should pay $300 million of tax. I don't think you apply rules differently based on the size of the company. We don't in Australia. Companies in Australia, Australian-based companies, pay tax on the first dollar they earn. They pay tax on the 10 millionth dollar that they earn.
So you don't think that we should be applying this rule only to companies that have a turnover of more than $1 billion?
Absolutely not. If the rule applies, it applies to everyone. Companies don't get a tax-free threshold like individuals. We don't say to companies, if you earn less than $18,000 a year, you don't pay tax. We say that to individuals, but not to companies. So why would we say it to multinational companies that your figure's got to be above a particular level?
Do we even know how many companies this will target?
I think that we would have some idea as to the number of companies involved in that. But again, if I'm a multinational company, you don't necessarily know how much money I'm earning in Australia. Let's take the companies that we don't talk about, the gambling companies and the online pornography companies. They earn money in Australia. How much do they earn in Australia? Do we really know? But the problem, of course, with many online is that I can purely operate out of a totally different country. I can earn my advertising revenue in Australia. I can earn my subscription revenue in Australia. But I actually have no based Australian income to pay tax on.
One of the things that Joe Hockey was keen to do in his press conference was to reinforce the message that the government has put $87 million into the ATO to focus on this issue of multinational tax avoidance. He says the government is sending a clear message that Australia has no tolerance for tax avoiders. Do you think that that is a message that is going to be heard by those companies? And if so, what are the ramifications?
I think it is fair that we have no tolerance for a whole range of things, but that doesn't mean that people are going to stop doing it. We have no tolerance for speeding, but that doesn't mean that people don't speed in their motor vehicles. What you have to do is you have to set up a system where you can, in fact, find out what the income is and then tax it. You know, I'll take you back to the old days when Kerry Packer appeared before the House of Representatives Committee in Canberra back in about 1992. He was questioned about the level of tax he paid and he said, I pay the tax I'm legally required to pay. What do you want me to do? Make a donation. That's fundamental to it. You cannot turn to a company and say you should pay your fair share of tax.
But that fair share should be set out in the law and there should be no loopholes that they can get out of so that they end up being able to reduce their taxable income to zero, which many companies have.
There will always be loopholes because the law cannot foresee every possibility and every circumstance associated with it.
Okay, but other countries, though, have multinational tax avoidance strategies in place, the UK, New Zealand, Canada. Are they operating those more successfully than we are? And if so, how are they doing it?
I don't think they are operating it more successfully. Politically, they may be saying that they're operating it more successfully. But for instance, if you want an opinion as to how successful England operates its anti-tax measures, talk to the new Labour leader in England and see what he thinks about their ability to do it. The public relations may be that they're operating it relatively successfully, but I think in reality they've got problems with it. The other issue you really have to consider in international tax agreements is that large countries in which many multinationals are based have an incentive for that company not to pay tax in Australia, because for every dollar tax in Australia they pay, it's a dollar less that they pay in their own country. And so when we come down to international tax agreements, it is often a zero-sum game. What Australia gets out of it, another country loses. And therefore, the ability, the willingness of other countries to participate in the process is not as great as the politicians at G20 meetings or the like would like to put on the table. They have their own selfish reasons.
Joe Hockey was seen as underperforming as a treasurer and was one of the first people that was touted to go under the leadership change, with Malcolm Turnbull now Prime Minister and the Treasury portfolio being handed over to Scott Morrison. Was Joe Hockey such a bad performer as a treasurer?
Now I will disagree with 99% of your audience and I will tell them that Joe Hockey was a good treasurer. He was a dreadful communicator. And the thing that amazes me about that is if you go back to 2009 in the preferred Liberal leader, Joe Hockey was number one. And he was number one because of his performance on the Sunrise program, his performance originally with Kevin Rudd. The program. He was seen as being the great communicator.
What happened?
Well, remember that last Thursday, Joe had been treasurer in Australia for just 2 years. And if we were sitting here just over 2 years ago, I would have said, look, I'm worried about whether he will be a good treasurer, but I think he'll do a fabulous job at selling whatever they've done. For me, the amazing part is that it was exactly the reverse of that.
John Tyler, Deputy Head of Accounting at the UTS Business School. The new laws will apply from January 1.
Money. Ride the gravy train with us.
You're on the Money. I'm Catherine Zangara.
The recovery from the Great Recession has advanced sufficiently far, and domestic spending appears sufficiently robust that an argument can be made for a rise in interest rates at this time. We discussed this possibility at our meeting. However, in light of the heightened uncertainties abroad and a slightly softer expected path for inflation, the committee judged it appropriate to wait for more evidence, including some further improvement in the labor market, to bolster its confidence that inflation will rise to 2% in the medium term.
Well, all year, Janet Yellen, the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the equivalent of our Reserve Bank governor, has been warning that the U.S. would be increasing interest rates as their economy starts to pick up. The Fed has kept interest rates at virtually zero since the GFC in order to try to stimulate them out of recession. The question has been not whether they'll raise interest rates, but when, which could be a cue for our own Reserve Bank to raise rates here. But in a surprise move, at the Federal Reserve meeting on Thursday, they voted not to change interest rates. Stable unemployment rates and reasonable growth figures set the scene to make it look doable, so why did they elect not to go ahead? Roderick Chambers spoke with Dr. Nicholas Gruen of Fairfax's Lateral Economics to find out what has happened to the Fed's plans.
By the time they came to the decision, the markets rated the chances of a rise at about a third, about 34%. So the betting was already that there wouldn't be a rise. But about a few weeks before that, the betting was about 54%. So if you're looking for the difference between the world a month ago in the world today, that's China and the various gyrations on the Chinese stock market and the fallout from that. So if you believe that that changed their mind, and we can't know, by the time it came to the meeting, it wasn't such a big surprise. But it's also the case that the Fed wasn't unanimous. So there are some people who want to raise rates. Anyway,
is Janet Yellen one of those? She was one of the ones that wants to raise?
I don't know. Well, she keeps saying she is, and I think she's playing a game a little like Bernanke, which is that I think she's a dove who needs to placate some hawks in there. So that's my guess, and I stress I could sound much wiser by using different terms, but we're all guessing.
And one of the reasons it's been talked about that we haven't had an increase is the devaluation of the Chinese yuan, because that would have a double whammy effect, I suppose, to the US economy. Could you explain what those two effects would be?
Well, the devaluation of the Chinese yuan effectively revalues the American dollar, and that's effectively a tightening that makes American exports less competitive and therefore is the opposite of a stimulus to American activity and a stimulus to Chinese activity. So that's another reason for saying that, in the words of Larry Summers, the markets have already done some tightening. They haven't tightened on interest rates, but the way in which the share market has fallen and the American dollar has risen, both have impacts on the monetary and business conditions in the United States, both of which slow down economic activity.
When we're talking about tightening and so forth, we're meaning that it's the supply of money, the ease in which you can get funds is being tightened, aren't we?
Correct. Yeah. Well, we're talking about getting the federal funds rate off the floor of zero to 0.25%, which is where it's been since the crisis, not day one of the crisis, but, you know, the global financial crisis. It fell to that level not that long afterwards, and it's been sitting there. And there are a lot of people who want to get it off the floor, and it's almost it's a sort of a fashion statement. What I mean by that is that there are genuine concerns about interest rates being that low that it tends to blow bubbles in various financial markets. The only problem that I see with that logic, if you really want to tackle bubbles that are developing using monetary policy, increasing the federal funds rate by 0.25% isn't going to do it for you. So I don't think that kind of logic makes any sense. I think it's kind of it's a fairly typical bit of magical thinking. People sort of look that there are all sorts of anxieties people have, many of which are legitimate, and then they try and get those anxieties, they try and work out what does that mean for the federal funds rate. But if you're anxious about bubbles in the economy, then there's no point in tackling that with a 0.25% interest rate rise. You'd need to tackle it with a 2-4% rise, and that would completely kill the economy. So I think you'd need to come up with another plan, and that plan has to be something to do with prudential supervision and so on, not killing the economy to prevent a bubble developing.
Well, we've been a bit preoccupied with our own bubble here in the Sydney property market, haven't we? And of course, interest rates from our own Reserve Bank sort of feed into that. Now, exactly. With the US no longer going to be tightening, well, not for the next month anyway, how do you think that's going to affect the Reserve Bank's decision making?
I don't think it will do anything, but I've on the record as saying that I think it should. I mean, we're in a very unusual situation now as far as the our Reserve Bank, our central bank, is concerned, which is that it has forecasts, public forecasts, for the economy to deteriorate, that is, for unemployment to rise, and its public forecasts don't have its target, its inflation target, being breached, and yet it's not cutting, and there is room to cut interest rates, and it's not cutting interest rates. So we're in a world of a completely different textbook, and we haven't been told what the textbook is.
There's no economic principles that we normally rely upon being used here, are there?
It's seat of the pants, and it's a list of anxieties. As I say, they're perfectly legitimate anxieties, but we're flying by the seat of the pants, and there are no, to my knowledge, Reserve Bank discussion papers, research papers, which explore the costs and benefits of the choices that we're making.
How then do you think we should look for interest rates from the US for the next couple of, or the rest of the year, I suppose? Should we factor in an increase, do you think?
Well, that's in the realm of clairvoyance, and we love to talk about this stuff. It's like talking about who's going to win the grand final.
Yes.
We don't really know. My guess is that all that talk about the Fed wanting to raise rates won't amount to a rate rise this year, but that's a guess. It also happens to be my guess about what the Fed should do. And often, us pundits have got a bit of a problem that if we think the Fed should do something, we often predict that it will do something. Anyway, having tried as much as I can to make that distinction in my own mind, I'm still going to predict, A, the Fed shouldn't raise rates unless the economy picks up very strongly, and B, that it won't. But I might be wrong.
Yeah. In that case, could I ask for your bet on Glenn Stevens' response then? Is he going to raise anything?
My bet on Glenn Stevens... Well, there you are. Now I can show you I'm an honest man. My bet on Glenn Stevens is, or the board of the Reserve Bank, is that it should cut rates and that it won't cut rates.
Nicholas Gruen, CEO of Lateral Economics, there with his tip for interest rates, ending that report by Roderick Chambers.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
On the Money, I'm Catherine Zengara. Despite our superannuation funds being some of the biggest pots of money in the world, Australian investors have a reputation for conservatism. This is a big problem for Aussie startups who need access to funds to build their business. Contrast this to America, where startups can receive millions of dollars even before they turn a profit. In the next segment of our series on startups and Australia's emerging tech industry, we look at the challenges of building a business without the capital. Ellen Leibeater and Josh Nicholas explain.
What I love about it is that ability to make something out of nothing.
Australian investors are very conservative.
And yes, the culture has been too unforgiving of failure.
If we're saying that the future of society is down this technological path,
I definitely foresee this as being a massive problem.
Start Me Up, the challenges facing Australia's knowledge economy, with Josh Nicholas and Ellen Leibeater.
When you think about the jobs of the future, what comes to mind?
Robot psychologist?
I would like to express an opinion.
You have my permission?
You are a quack.
What?
A quack.
Well, as long as I get a robot cleaner first. The point is that the future is all about tech. And with the mining boom ending, the jobs of the future don't seem that far away.
Australia's economy is going through a huge transition now, and many people believe that technology is the key. It's called a knowledge economy, and it means that rather than building physical things, we can build virtual ones.
Rather than printing maps, we can code apps.
This transition is already underway. There are thousands of people across the country working on apps and websites. I'm Ellen Lee Bader.
And I'm Josh Nicholas.
We've been investigating Australia's emerging knowledge economy. How hard is it to get started in Australia? What are the challenges tech entrepreneurs face? And how can we make it easier?
We learn in the first segment of this series there are heaps of challenges facing entrepreneurs. And if we want a knowledge economy, we're going to need every startup we can get.
Today we want to look at finance. The founders we've been talking to have all complained about finding investments to start and grow their business. Here's James Cooter, founder of Hobart-based Savage Interactive. We talked to him in the first segment.
When we closed the company down, we were left with about, after everything had been paid, we were left with about $20,000 in the bank. And we decided, well, we're going to just use that.
Now, $20,000 sounds like a pitiful sum when you compare it to the millions and even billions some American startups can raise.
And probably the biggest difference is that they can raise this cash long before they have any revenue. Just think of Snapchat. It was raking in millions in investments long before ads popped up.
And there are thousands of stories like this in America. In the first 3 months of this year alone, American venture capitalists plowed more than $13 billion into American startups. To put that in perspective, Gina Reinhart is worth about $12 billion.
But don't just listen to us and James whinge about it. Here's Belle Beth Cooper. She's the co-founder of a relatively new Melbourne-based startup called Hello Code. Hello Code face similar concerns with getting funding.
Whenever we've talked to anyone about possibilities for getting funding in Australia, we generally run into the same theme about investors, which is that Australian investors are very conservative and don't like to take big risks. I need a dollar, dollar,
dollar, that's what I need. Hey, hey, well, I need. Belle has an interesting point there. Australia isn't exactly short on cash. Because of our superannuation system, we have some of the largest funds anywhere in the world. Why aren't our startups swimming in investments?
It's a good question. I took it to Aaron Berkby. He's a co-founder of an incubator on the Gold Coast. We'll take a closer look at incubators in a later segment, but basically they are organisations that tech startups go to for advice and contacts. Anyway, here's Aaron on why superannuation funds aren't investing in our tech startups.
It's really hard, right? So for super funds to be interested, super funds are massive. So when they write a check, it's for $100 million plus. So their cost of doing due diligence and all that, there's no interest in them doing small fry stuff. So really the only model for them to move into this space would be to be throwing money into venture capital funds. So some other fund manager that then manages that investment.
So to clear up a couple of points here, our superannuation funds are so massive that they can't really afford to make small bets on a bunch of startups.
Right. In the United States, what a superannuation fund would do is give their money to what's called a venture capitalist. Basically, someone that specializes in investing in really small companies.
And the reason why Australia doesn't have venture capitalists? Well, Aaron has the answer for that too.
We just have a really bad history of returns for VCs in the country, so it's no wonder people don't want to invest in that asset class.
So we wanted to find an Australian investor. Do they agree that Aussie investors are conservative? What do they look for in a company? How many startups do they turn away?
I have just the man.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Chong. I'm a partner at RightClick Capital.
RightClick Capital is a Sydney-based investment firm, and they're focused on exactly what we're talking about, tech startups.
So is he investing in things left, right and centre?
No. Benjamin says that Australian investors are so risk adverse. For example, his company invested in just 5 of the more than 200 applications that they received last year. That said, he thinks the tide is turning.
I'd say that the tide is turning. It might be a bit slow for some, but I think things are changing.
But it still isn't enough to just have a good idea.
I'd say that when it comes to ideas, many of us have them. We wake up, we might have an idea, we might get the bus, we have an idea. And if the idea is from someone who does have a proven track record, from a team of people who have a proven track record, and who can demonstrate that that idea does seem to meet a need that is faced by many people, this big market, then yes, it is possible. But generally speaking, there are things that can be done to demonstrate that that idea is more than something on a sheet of paper.
So it's more than just the quality of the idea. Benjamin's basically saying that he's not just backing the idea, but the people behind it as well.
We look for a number of things, but the first thing that makes us have our ears prick up would be the quality of founders. So we like founders who have some sort of track record, preferably. Founders who have either a combination of business, of technical, and of some domain experience.
So, some hope for budding tech entrepreneurs then?
Well, yeah. And we've heard from some of the other people that we've talked to that American investors are starting to come to Australia to invest in our companies. So, the ball is rolling.
That's all for now. Keep your ears peeled. Next time, we'll be taking a look at some of the other challenges and opportunities in Australia's knowledge economy.
Ellen Leibeater and Josh Nicholas with their series on startups. Next week, they'll be looking at why our best and brightest are seeking their startup opportunities overseas. That's it for On the Money this week. Thanks to our reporters, Roderick Chambers, Ellen Leibeater and Josh Nicholas. You can find all our podcasts at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Why not follow us on Twitter? Look for @onthemoney2ser, and you can find us on Facebook as well. I'm Catherine Zangara. Thanks for your company.